HD.
Garden City.
Long Island.
New York. Friday afternoon on a beautiful, this is just before a gorgeous week, a gorgeous weekend is predicted. Today's been great. Chances are you're in your car riding somewhere, whatever you're doing. I'm hoping you're about to do something fun, or maybe you're already doing something fun. I'm so glad you're joining us for this hour. Time for American Hit Radio on 90.3 WHPC. I'm Tom Ryan, the host of the program, lovely wife and Heidi Morales, co-host and engineer as well. And today, we're really going to be testing
What's my name?
Heidi Morales. Ryan.
Thank you.
That's better. About that.
Now I know that you're angry at me because you always forget that I'm a Ryan when you're angry.
Is that right?
Yep.
See the subtleties. Even I'm not aware of that. But we're going to have some fun with the music. We'll be fine. I'll get if I have any anger, I'll get over it.
I hope.
I got really frightened just now, to be honest, because we bring our music here to the show. I used to always bring it on discs that I burn, and that was kind of flawless. We really never had problems doing that. Maybe occasionally there would be a track that would flub doing it that way. But now we're bringing them on thumb drives, and it seems as though like I'm having a lot of issues, and today's show didn't come up. So we're gonna have to more or less do this on the fly. And I hope that it's okay and that we managed to pull it off. Now, of course, we've been covering The Who this is show number 36. We're going to be pushing close to a year covering The Who, which is pretty remarkable, but also pretty awesome because the history is awesome. But we are up to a very difficult part in the time in the band's history, the late 70s, at the passing of Keith Moon. And obviously, there's really no such thing as a timely death. Keith's passing came at an incredibly awkward time for The Who. He was the kind of person that most people were surprised that he even survived at all, but yet he shocked everybody when he actually did pass. Now, coming on the heels of their new album release, Who Are You?, which we had just covered in the past couple of weeks, all plans for promotion were scuttled by the news, and worse, the bands had two movies ready for release. One was a documentary, The Kids Are All Right, which we did cover mostly last week as well. And the other, the band's second major motion picture, Quadrophenia, was about to be released. Now, Quadrophenia never really seemed to get the respect that it deserved back in 1973. And even The Who had problems bringing it into their live show. But at the dawn of the 80s, an entirely new light was shed on England's mod culture, and The Who were elevated to iconic status by this new generation of punk musicians who saw the band as rock and roll heroes. Overnight, almost, The Who seemed to experience a rebirth of sorts, even though they had, for all intents and purposes, ceased to exist, at least temporarily. The circumstances were so unusual that the band was nearly forced into the awkward situation of quickly determining a way to carry on without Keith. That's what this show is going to cover, and we're going to do it by playing music from the film version of Quadrophenia, the remixes, which mostly do feature Keith. And also, it's the first time that Kenny recorded anything with the band for the tracks that don't. Now, this, to start off today's show, is an excerpt of Pete Townsend writing from his own autobiography, Who I Am. In Malibu, Keith was drinking very hard, and I couldn't keep up. Instead of helping him, I got caught up in his great parade and almost forgot why I'd gone over to see him in the first place. But something I'd said had touched him. We wanted him to come home, all of us. When I got back to London, Keith was called to ask if I'd rent Harry Nilsson's flat opposite the Playboy Club for him. He wanted to come home but had no money. I spoke to Harry, who agreed to it, but told me he was worried. The place was cursed. Mama Cass had died in that flat. I assured him lightning wouldn't strike twice in the same place. Bill Wyman had a place on the same block and tried gamely to keep an eye on Keith. One evening, Bill Wyman and Spiros Nirakos, son of the Greek shipping magnate Stavros Nirakos, arranged to meet Keith in his third-floor flat and have some drinks with him. Keith, in a rock tradition that he himself may have started, had hired his own minder, instructed him not to let him escape, then set about proving he couldn't be contained. In the middle of enjoying a quiet drink, Keith drifted to the window, opened it, and, without seeming to give the slightest thought to anything at all, simply jumped out. Bill and Spiros ran to the window to see Keith lying on his back on several mattresses he'd previously piled up in a construction dumpster. He got up, brushed himself off, and shouted up past the gasping onlookers, "See you at the Playboy Club. Mine's an orange juice." At the time, Keith was juggling doctors to create confusion and to get the most medication he could, especially to relieve the symptoms of alcohol withdrawal. But he seemed determined to stay sober, at least. He rang me almost every night, almost always around midnight, to say that he loved me. But in September 1978, Roger called me at the studio. He was succinct. He'd done it. The incredibly charged emotions around Keith's death made me lose all logic. I was convinced that everything would be okay if we could only play, perform, and tour. I now see that although I had worried for a long time about Keith dying, I had never really believed it would happen. I was shaken to my foundations and my mind flipped. Without grief in its usual manifestation, I had to find a different way to deal with my loss. You can say I was in denial. Keith had been a pain in the ass, but he had also been a constant joy. All that was left was a sense of his ghost playing the drums, laughing as he played Who Are You with his earphones on fire. Let's get to some of the tracks from the Quadrophenia soundtrack film. These are songs that we played when we covered the album proper, but as the soundtrack came out and the movie came out, it became something of a cult favorite among punks because it was the punks who, A, had like almost like a total love for The Who, and also the fact that the film had basically put a loving light onto mod culture, which was a very strong influence on the punk scene as well. This track then from the Quadrophenia soundtrack is called The Real Me on 90.3 WHPC.
Real me, can ya? Can ya?
Yeah. come down is calling, loneliness starts sinking in, but I'm one, I'm one, and I can see that this is me, and I will be, you'll all see I'm the one. Without a case, but I can't get that even tanned look on my face. Ill-fitting clothes, and I blend in the crowd. Fingers so clumsy, voice too loud.
What we're hearing essentially are mostly the same basic tracks that were used for the album Quadrophenia, but remixed and a few overdubs added here and there. I think in that case on I'm One, you can hear Rabbit Bundrick's piano, which I don't think was on the original track on the album. So there's some, it could be said that the film soundtrack actually improves a little bit on the awesomeness of the original album, which is why and it's worth revisiting since, like I said, the songs are so great. They're so strong. And there isn't enough examples of The Who playing this stuff live from this era because they didn't really incorporate much of it into their show. Now, going back just even a little bit, to just this is the same, well, basically another an accounting of Keith's passing. This time it's by Richard Barnes, who was actually one of The Who's oldest friends, the man responsible for coming up with the name The Who. And we've been using his book called Maximum R&B for much of our history. On August 12th, Pete Meaden, the band's former publicist and chief inspiration for their early mod image and high numbers period, died in London. He apparently committed suicide. Pete had been managing the Steve Gibbons Band along with Bill Kerbishley. I had seen him some months before and had a drink with him. I'd always liked Pete and was quite upset, as he was clearly very unhappy and unsure of himself. If The Who were very upset at Pete Meaden's death, they were completely and utterly shattered a month later on September 7th when Keith died. He had been at a party at Peppermint Park Restaurant in London before the premiere of the Buddy Holly story given by Paul McCartney, who owns the copyright to Buddy Holly songs. Keith had announced his engagement to his beautiful Swedish girlfriend, Annette Walter Lax, with whom he had been living for the past 2 years. Keith often announced that he was going to marry, but most people present thought that he actually meant it this time. According to David Frost, who was at the same table as Paul and Linda and Keith and Annette, Keith was relaxed and content and really delightful company. He spent his last evening sipping white wine. They went to see the film, leaving after 45 minutes to return to his flat in the Curzon Place, where Keith watched The Abominable Dr. Phoebs on video and had some supper. Sometime during the evening, he took some pills and fell asleep with the video still running. According to the story that Annette told to the Sunday Mirror, he woke up early in the morning and said that he was hungry again. I started moaning and complaining that it was inconsiderate of him to expect me to get up and cook another meal. "If you don't like it, you can bluff off," he said. Those were the last words that he spoke to me. Keith had been prescribed by his doctor the drug, Haminivrin, a sedative used to treat acute alcoholic withdrawal symptoms and acute mania. These were Keith's two big problems. However, some medical opinion has it that Keith should never have been prescribed the drug unless he was under supervision in hospital, and treatment shouldn't last more than 6 or 7 days. Keith had been taking them for weeks. Keith ate the steak that Annette had prepared and went back to sleep. He took another handful of sedatives. It had first been prescribed after he had had an epileptic fit as a result of his withdrawal from alcohol. Keith had taken 32 tablets in all that night. The sedative can be affected by even a small amount of alcohol, making it very dangerous.
Yikes.
Annette woke up the following afternoon at about 2 o'clock and found Keith dead. Very sad. Back to the soundtrack. These are the recordings that still feature Keith Moon. So in his death, in a lot of ways, this movie was an incredible tribute to the talent of the man, because I think some of his best work occurred on the album Quadrophenia, and these remixes just prove just how astounding they really are. Here's 515 from the soundtrack on 90.3 WHBC.
Yeah. only love. They can bring me away the beach. It's kissed by the sea. Only love. They can bring me like the sweat of lovers laying in the field.
One major difference between the Quadrophenia album by The Who and the Quadrophenia film soundtrack is the order of the tracks. They are in a significantly different order for the film. And it's interesting because we had, Heidi and I had watched the movie just before doing this show. And it's one of the things that we noticed was that the songs were basically taken in a different order than they were presented on the album. But it didn't hurt the story. And in a lot of ways, it seemed to have made just as much sense in the order that they were on. I mean, I totally understand why Pete would have wanted to close the album with Love Rain Over Me. But from a movie's perspective, that wouldn't have been dramatic enough. So by them rearranging the songs, it really helped to build the tension so that at the end, when Jimmy's stolen scooter goes off of a cliff and you see the scooter falling into the sea, you don't see Jimmy. It lets you decide for yourself whether he went over
what
with it
to him. Yeah.
or if he stayed on the edge, so to speak.
It's far more subtle that way.
Yeah, and very dramatic.
And
the soundtrack works brilliantly in that way. The soundtrack also contains a lot of hits, non-Who songs. There's an entire side of them. Things like the Ronettes and a couple of other, like I said, non-Who tracks, just to round out like what the mod music was at the time. So it's essentially Quadrophenia boiled down to three sides. So there's a lot of the extraneous stuff that had been removed. Back to Pete's autobiography, talking a little bit further on about Keith's passing. At Keith's funeral, Roger was the one in the band who seemed most affected. Perhaps that's why I took charge. It had been Charlie Watts, whose eyes were full of tears as he remembered his old friend. My eyes were hard and dry. Phil Collins called me and offered his services, and I knew he would make a great drummer for us. But he was building a solo career and was still touring and recording with Genesis. How could it work? He assured me that he could do it. But I wanted Kenny Jones. He was my friend. I had worked with him quite a bit, and I liked the idea of having a drummer who kept strict time so I didn't have to do it. I felt Kenny's work with the Small Vases had been inventive, but restrained. Cool is the word. In addition to putting together the new band, I was swept up in other work. The Quadrophenia movie was going into production. Johnny Rotten and I had met, got drunk, became friends, and we talked about him playing the lead. But we both ultimately agreed that he shouldn't try to play a tidy little mod. That would have been odd, but it also would have been pretty amazing.
Yeah, it would
all have. Around. All right, let's pick up where we left off then, another track. This is the track that was Keith's highlight moment on the album and still part of the soundtrack for the movie itself. Here's Bellboy on 90.3 WHS.
Where a man can feel is the only soul. money now.
Bellboy.
Take the lip button down.
Bellboy.
Turn the bloody baggage out.
Bellboy.
Always running at someone's ear. You know I'm. Always running at someone's
heel. It's time. Watch the NBA Finals live on...
When That right there is the scene where the bike goes off of the cliff and ends the movie. If you haven't seen the movie, I highly recommend it because it's a great piece of work. It's something to see. What I'd like to do, though, now, besides covering the movie, talk a little bit about how Kenny Jones had ended up coming in to replace Keith. On the soundtrack, there were a number of songs that did not appear on the album. And it was Kenny who came in to record some of these songs. So it was really the first time that a Who recording came out that was not featuring Keith Moon on drums. Rather strange. I didn't even realize that at the time. But we're going crazy over here in the background, folks, just that you don't know what's happening. But because, like I said, my thumb drive didn't work, and we're scrambling to find other ways to get all these tracks up, and we're dealing with...
And the internet petered out all of a sudden.
Yeah, exactly. We're dealing with internet services and such to serve our purpose, and we're scrambling. But so far, so good. So far, very good. Thank you very much, Andy. That's fabulous that you got it back. Thank you. But let's play three tracks that were not on the Quadrophenia album. We'll see what we can get. Hopefully they are there. As I said, these are the first recordings that featured a non-Keith Moon Who on 90.3 WHPC. Let's start with this track called Get Out and Stay Out.
Which I'm over here, I'm trying to brush my teeth. It's little things that are hard, like starting up the car, and I'm still underneath.
Joker James, you did it again. He's a joker, he's a joker.
It's Kenny Jones making his debut appearance as a drummer for The Who on those tracks, on the soundtrack. Now we'll finish with just another excerpt from Pete Townsend's autobiography, Who I Am. The new Who started rehearsing at Shepperton in April 1979 with Rabbit and Kenny Jones, who we were still auditioning. I managed to persuade Roger and John to let me rehearse a four-piece brass section to bring our many unplayed Quadrophenia tracks to life.
Well, this sounds a lot like you.
We spent an entire month working. I felt that the old Who was dead and buried along with Keith, so for me, the new band was a new opportunity, one that could never have taken place had Keith lived on. I became suspect in this manner. Some people felt that I had been happy, or at least opportunistic, about Keith's death. Sometimes I may have come close to admitting in a clumsy expression of gratitude that tragedy could lead to rebirth. Roger, on the other hand, always regarded The Who as part of a personal continuum, a story that began in 1960 when he had formed his first band and continued when he had invited first John, then me, to join him straight from school. He wanted the band to evolve, to replace Keith with someone as expressive and passionate. Roger admired Kenny's drumming and liked him as a human being, but felt he wasn't the right drummer for the band. I told Roger I'd carried on with The Who, but only on my terms. If he didn't feel comfortable with that, I could make solo records and do shows on my own. The future was very much still up in the air, and I have no idea what Bill Kersley would have been advising Roger behind the scenes. In May 1979, the new Who performed their inaugural show at the Rainbow in London. It went on a bit. I think that was my fault, but it felt good. I was happy and it showed. The exhaustive rehearsals paid off. Kenny was great. Rabbit inspired me at every turn. Roger played the hard man in a leather jacket, his hair cut short. He was fantastic that night, and so was John. The reviews were good, too. We'll leave you with this last track, then, from the soundtrack. I think you know what this is. The Punk and the Godfather. Again, from the soundtrack version. Take care, folks. We'll see you next week.